Hey everyone, and welcome to our podcast, Caution Wide Right. It's just another trucking podcast, and today we have a trucking company that's been around for 40 years, who's been heavily involved with the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association, and delivers all sorts of loads from the Mississippi River to the East Coast, from Canada to Florida. And so with me today is the president of JAG Trucks, Zach Germack. Zach, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me today.
Now, I don't really know where to begin with a company like JAG Trucks, involved with so much stuff. So let's just start with the beginning. I know JAG Trucks founded in 1982 by your dad, Jim. And I was curious, he said that he always wanted to be a truck driver. Is this something that, like the driver culture back in the 70s with movies like Convoy or Smokey and the Bandit, or what got him interested in trucking as far as you remember?
My dad was always a hardworking guy, and he grew up in Middletown, Pennsylvania, about three blocks off the main drag, and just seeing the trucks go up and down the road. You know, that was before Route 283 and
sure,
and some of the other interstates. So you saw the trucks going by, and you know, man, where did they come from? Where are they going? Just the adventure of it, I think, drew him at first. Then some of his earlier jobs put him in a truck and got him into it that way.
And so he was an owner-operator for a while. How long was he an owner-operator for?
So he bought his first truck when he was 21, and he bought a brand-new F-model cab over Mac.
Nice.
Does
he still have it?
No, we do not have it. I'm not even sure where it's at.
Yep.
But he bought that in when he was 21, and I think it was 72. And then he was leased on to Jones Motor for 10 years. And then he had the opportunity to get his own authority and go out on his own. And that's what happened. He ended with Jones on a Friday and started as JAG Trucks on a Monday.
You know, so owner going on your own versus driving for a company is a completely different mind switch. Do you know if he's talked about that at all, about that transition to being an owner-operator, doing your own business?
Yeah, it was kind of funny you asked that, because him and I were talking just this morning about some of that, like trying to grow your business and some things like that, and trying to have your owner, your leased operators or even employees understand there's so much more on the back end of a business than just delivering freight. And he said that when he was at Jones, when I was at Jones, I'm out here, doing all the work, I'm doing everything, and the company's making all the money. Mm-hmm. Well, now he understands that, there's a whole lot going on the back end that no one really sees. All the compliance, all the insurance, not just DOT compliance, but HR compliance.
Oh, yeah.
The accounting side of things, the taxes, everything. There's just so much that happens behind the scenes that people don't see. You think I'm just going to, file a few papers with the DOT and get my number, and then I'm good to go. It doesn't matter if you have one truck or 5,000, you still have to follow the same rules.
Yeah, no, totally. And that's what we have a trucking startup series where we sort of dive into, have a game plan, know what to expect, save money up for it, because it's not also the cheapest thing in the world. But you got also dispatching, which is a completely different thing, building relationships, which a lot of drivers just want to drive truck. Well, there's the whole sales side of it, too, if you're going to be an owner-operator, being a salesperson.
Yeah.
So that's a completely different mindset as well. It's always interesting. And I'm curious, too, because so he was an owner-operator for a while, and then eventually he started building the company. When did he start adding more trucks and drivers?
Not long after, he left Jones. He was doing things on his own. And then some friends of his, hey, this is what I'm doing, and it seemed to work out.
Yep.
So he leased on some more of his friends and guys he knew, and Started that way.
Nice.
At one time, we were more owner-operators than we were company trucks. Then that kind of switched a little bit to more company trucks than owner-operators, and now we're kind of getting the other way again. So we kind of ebb and flow with owner-operators and company trucks depending on how well the economy is. You know, right. The owner-operators obviously do much better when the economy is doing well. If you own your own truck and, you know, things get tight, it may be easier to be a company driver, you know. So the one thing that we've done in our business with owner-operators is we've had numerous drivers that wanted to own their own truck, but they weren't quite sure about it. So they would come drive a company truck for us for a few months, few years, and then they're like, hey, I want to do this. I want to have my own truck. I want to do this on my own. So they would go out and buy a truck, lease it back onto us. They would be an owner-operator. And I have several of them that are still with us 20 years doing that.
That's awesome. I do want to touch on the owner or the independent contractor piece too. There's a lot there. AB5, independent contractor law in California, and there's, you know, the difference of how much are they actually doing the owner operator piece versus you guys handling fuel taxes or you guys handling insurance or something else like that. That whole balance is very interesting to me. So we'll touch on that in a second. But I'm curious, for you growing up with your dad's heavily involved in the trucking industry. You know, I grew up in the military brat, so my dad and the culture around the military. I'm curious, what was it like growing up under the trucking industry, under your dad's passion for trucks?
It was just, that was life.
Yeah.
You know, it was our first shop and everything was at our house.
Yeah,
cool. So when I grew up, it was the trucks were always there. Yeah. The shop was there. There's stories of me riding my tricycle through the shop and the guys working at the shop getting mad. I don't remember that. But so we moved to our current location in 1997.
Okay.
So I'd have been in high school at the time. But when I was young, growing up, trucks always around, that's just what it was. You know, you didn't think of it like, you know, in school you would ask, oh, what's your dad do? He owns a trucking company. I thought everybody owned a trucking company, you know? So I never really knew his job title. We had trucks and he worked and, you know, you work 6 days a week and you got it done, you know? So
very cool.
You didn't really know much else.
Yeah, and so now you mentioned the new property. It's like 75 acres of property. It used to be an abandoned locomotive repair maintenance shop location repair shop there in Marietta. I think that's a 1940s railroad.
The facility we're at now is part of the old Olmsted Air Force Base.
Oh, cool.
They built it in the 40s. You know, the rumor, like 1,000 brick masons or something, constructed all these buildings and everything. Like our shop that we're in is a complete brick.
Right.
It's not just like a brick facade. Like there are 12 inch thick brick walls and, you know, our shop floor still has railroad tracks in it.
Wow.
So that was just kind of abandoned when we came across it. We talked to the owner. And we started leasing that building, and then we eventually bought it. And then we bought some other sections of that property to what we have today.
Cool. And I know it's mentioned on the website that you guys renovated it. I'm curious about any renovating stories. What was it like at that location?
That building, it was basically four walls and half a roof.
Oh, geez.
The windows were all boarded up. The roof had big holes in it. The overhead doors didn't open, you know. So we basically had to go in and tear all the boarded up windows out, put all new windows in it, put a new roof, new ceiling, electric, water, sewer, man. You know. So it was, you were basically redoing the building without putting up the walls.
Nice little investment project there.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Seems to be working out great today. So.
Yeah.
And so, you know, now the property now, full service maintenance shop, you know, offices, cross dock facilities, secure trailers, storage lots, And your website mentions that Jag Trucks always thrived on solving the customer's unique needs through innovative means. And I'm curious, what does innovative means mean for in this scenario?
Over the years, we work really close with our customers. We're not looking for the customer that just wants to get it done and pay the cheapest price.
Right.
We're looking for a long-term relationship, something that, you know, when times are good, we help. When times are bad, we help.
Yep.
You know, we don't want to be a flash in the pan. We want to be here for the long term. So part of that just most recently, we've seen the highest rates that you've seen ever.
Yeah, $2 a mile, I think, is officially.
Well, that's a cost. Out today from Commercial Carrier Journal, mm-hmm. the highest cost ever for operating trucks.
Yeah.
And, we want to be able to keep our pricing and keep our service levels as high as possible and our pricing as fair as possible. So when, you know, the spot market is through the roof and if our customer needs something done and everyone's asking an arm and a leg to get it done, you know, we know that we service that customer right now in a fair, affordable way.
Right.
We'll be there for the long term. You know, if you're the guy that's at the top of the rate chart and you're charging $18 a mile because you can,
right,
you're not going to be in business tomorrow.
And then how many people are accepting those rates that are like $1.30 a mile or something? It's like,
exactly. That kind of thing is hard to do as well. I mean, we have, as hard as it is to find drivers and good employees, we have to be able to pay them.
Yep.
You know, and with low rates, you can't do that.
Exactly. And do you see with the rates right now, so we're on a sort of market downtrend and hopefully hitting the bottom with these crappy rates. I'm curious, does this move those owner operators? Maybe they bought a truck during the peak of COVID and prices were expensive, but there was a lot of freight to move. And now it's the opposite. Are they looking to go independent owner operator or being leased on, or are they looking to become company drivers? I know a lot are getting out too.
We're seeing a lot more owner operators looking to come on, you know, with a company like us.
Right.
Because the, you know, steady freight. If you bought a truck and a trailer 2 years ago, you paid a lot of money for it because the used market was really up.
Yeah.
And the spot market was doing great, but now the spot market isn't so well. So you're trying to find somewhere to put your truck that you can pay your bills.
Right. Exactly. And so what, specifically with the leased on owner operators, what is your, like, why should they work for Jag Trucks? What's that relationship look like?
We don't have a rule book for our business that's this thick and you have to check every single box that when you come into work, you have to follow a very strict regimented schedule.
Right.
You know, we hire drivers that are able to be the professional driver that they want to be.
Exactly.
That there's not someone staring over their shoulder watching their GPS saying, why'd you make a left turn there? They have the freedom to be what truck driving is.
And that's obviously why a lot of owner-operators are being owner-operators, because they want that flexibility, that freedom, which I find awesome. And then with being leased on, if you can do it successfully, then you're also, hey, we'll hold your hand through this other part of it, whether it's fuel taxes or
yeah.
Do you cover... Are they on your guys' insurance as well?
We, with our leased owner operators, we cover their fuel taxes.
Right.
We cover their liability insurance okay. when they're under a load for us.
Right.
So they would need to have their own bobtail deadhead insurance, and also it's called like occupational accident insurance or workers' comp, whichever.
Right.
So if they're not under dispatch, if they're driving their truck from point A to point B and they were to get into an accident, it would be on their insurance.
Right.
But when they're under dispatch for us, our liability covers the liability for the truck and trailer and the load.
And so they have flexibility to find their own loads as well, if not under your guys' dispatch, right?
they have the flexibility to find their own loads, but they run under our DOT number.
Right.
So everything, if they found their own load, it would still run through our office.
Okay.
And they would get a higher percentage.
Interesting. Yeah, very cool. And so with the independent contractor piece, obviously California AB5, there's a lot of exemptions for the original intent, and then now truckers are getting screwed, and there's still a legal process that they're going through. But basically in California, they have to either hire on these independent contractors or they have to go on their own, which maybe they don't have the full experience as an owner-operator running every detail of their business. I'm just curious about your thoughts. Is AB5 something that you could see expanding down the road to other states? And what's your thoughts with it?
They've been trying. I know New Jersey was trying to implement that. I did see some other things in the news about AB5 and maybe getting it repealed or an exemption for trucks.
Right. We're trying.
But the owner-operator model that is in place today with like our company and so many others across the nation is so prevalent and it's worked well for so long.
Right.
I'm hoping we can get the legislatures to understand that, and the benefit of the owner-operator far outweighs the any negative things that may be perceived. I mean, I've grown up with this since I was little. We've had owner-operators. They're all hardworking guys and girls.
Oh, yeah.
They've all raised families. They've, bought houses, put their kids through college, the whole nine yards, and they've done it all, doing it for themselves and the company and the customer. And to try and take all that back and make them be a employee, it just doesn't seem like that's what we're here for.
Well, and it's just crazy because like in California, the original intent, or so they say, was, Uber and the, everyday car drivers. They were the ones that were supposed to be, there's this issue with, should they be an employee under Uber or not? But then they get the exemption and trucking doesn't, but they've had the model for decades. So it just seems weird that it wasn't such an easy exemption, apply it, yeah, okay, no problem, that they have to fight still with it. And I think there's news right now, they have another month or so of arguing and adding any other details they want for the fight to make an exemption claim. But we'll sort of see where that goes. But I agree. I hope it doesn't continue expanding down the road, or at least allowing those exemptions for the trucking industry, because just... companies want to go on their own, and owner-operators want to go on their own, they can go on their own.
Yeah.
But it seems more beneficial holding, being able to hold a hand being leased on if they need it. Just makes sense with the cycles of the trucking industry, really.
Well, exactly. You get the benefit of being a independent person, but you also get the benefit of multiple trucks, more equipment than you could, our truck to trailer ratio is like 7 to 1.
Right.
So we have drop trailers all over the East Coast, and our drivers can go in and, leave here, go to Columbus, drop and hook, go to Erie, drop and hook, go somewhere else, where if you were an independent guy with one truck and two trailers.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that is what puts a lot of time in the trucking industry. Like where they hear about, I have to sit and wait at this shipper to get unloaded, and I got here on Monday, but then they can't take it till Wednesday. Well, with drop and hook, it alleviates all of that.
Yep. And then also like I got to help unload the vehicle or things like that. That's interesting. I'm curious. So 7 to 1's your ratio. And I'm just curious, how does it building to that point? What was that like? Because, that's a lot of trailers. You guys have all kinds of different trailers too. Dry van, liquid, tankers, flatbeds.
My dad's a very frugal guy. So a lot to get us to that point, we don't go out and borrow millions of dollars and buy millions of dollars of brand new equipment.
Right.
One of the things that helped us get to that point, when I was a kid, my dad would buy wrecked Schneider trailers, and he could buy them for pennies on the dollar. And he had a handful of real good guys in the shop. They'd bring them in, tear them apart, put all kinds of new pieces in, paint them up, ship them out the door.
Nice.
So that helped get our numbers up real high. So now we can buy a little more late model equipment and still continue that. We don't do as much trailer rebuilding as we did when I was younger, but that's how we got to where we were with being able to have that much, that many trailers.
Interesting. And so you guys also do overdimensional loads. I believe you have like dry bulk tanks. I think I saw on the website, bottom discharge hopper. I'm just curious, do those constantly, are they constantly being moved in, whether it's dispatch, how is it handling all of that equipment?
You have certain guys have their niche,
right?
Not every driver goes and hooks to every type of trailer every day. You know, the dispatchers really understand how to make all that work. The dry bulk business, we bought a small company in Anvil, Pennsylvania years ago. That's where all that equipment came from. And we're still running some of those same customers today. That was probably 15 years ago or so we bought that. With those different type of equipment, it helps service our customers better,
right?
And it helps, you know, drive freights down. You know, maybe we're not running so many vans this month, but we're utilizing all of our curtain side equipment.
Right.
And some of the other types of our equipment that we have, it was all based on need of the customer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one thing that I tell our dispatchers and everything, don't say no.
Yep.
You know, if the customer comes at you with, hey, I need help with X, you know, that's what we do. We're here to solve problems. We're here to be an asset. And we don't just sit here and say, well, we can do A and B and that's it.
Yep. I think John here at this company is the same thing. Like we started as a DMV to, doing fuel taxes and things like that. And then every time customers were like, well, I wish can you help us with an audit or increasing safety scores? Can you help us train new CDL drivers? And so each piece slowly grew.
Yeah.
And now we do a little bit of everything on the safety side. Mm-hmm. Good. So let's flip to the employee driver side. So hiring drivers, I know there's an old article your dad was mentioning the discussion's been around driver shortage. I think at the time they were saying numbers like 40,000 driver shortage nationwide. Then eventually it'll go to 76 and then 100,000 plus. And we're actually sort of seeing those numbers grow according to the ATA. But do you actually believe it's a driver shortage problem or is it a turnover problem? Or what do you think?
I think some of it's a turnover issue. Like I feel like the big carrier, they have a model where they go into a trucking school and they gobble up every person they can grab. They throw them in a truck. They, you know, make them check all those little boxes every day. And then the person's like, what the heck am I doing here? And then they leave the industry.
Right.
You know, I see that slowly starting to change. You know, from when I was a kid, seeing truck drivers every day, my image of a truck driver was, you know, a guy in a pair of jeans and a button-up shirt and, you know, going to work every day.
Yep.
You know, he didn't jump out of the truck in flip-flops and basketball shorts. You know, he wasn't the guy that stood in the corner and said, well, I'm not going to do that and that, and you have to do this for me.
Right.
He was the guy that was out there getting it done every day,
busting,
solving problems, knew where he needed to be, when he needed to be there, was on time, you know, just a professional, courteous person. So I think that's part of the image that needs to be brought back.
Oh, totally.
And that would help fuel the shortage.
Is this a culture thing where, I don't know if it's, like, obviously COVID, we had a nice little time of, like, respecting the truckers that are delivering things, but then we were so easily to forget that as well. Is it a cultural thing? Is it this in-and-out churn of train a driver for a year, and then they're out in a year, and so we see that image of it? Or, you know, there's this fear of more drivers on the road, so people fear the big trucks because they cause the accidents, which is the other way around. But do you think it's cultural, or is, like, how would you go about changing something like that?
I know ATA has a big campaign for driver image.
Right.
And it, you know, some of the pictures I can see in my mind from that campaign is, you know, a guy coming home with his truck and gets out of the truck and his kids run up to him and they do this and, you know, he shows them around. And, you know, that's what I see as a truck driver.
Right.
A family guy, someone that's, like I said earlier, working hard and providing for his family. That's yep. what I think of when I think of a truck driver, not some guy that's out there, you know, wild and crazy, running down the highway, smoking in the bandit. That's not what I think of when I think of a truck driver.
Right.
And I just think that image needs to be portrayed more. And I think the ATA is doing a really good job at that.
Well, and I do think it's, you know, while social media harms a lot of it, I think there's this opportunity for truckers to be able to voice their opinions a lot more. I guess it goes with anything. If the trucking industry just sort of is more willing to speak up about certain things, whether it's with regulations, whether it's image, you know, social media can be such a good PowerPoint of highlighting the pros, the benefits, the realities of trucking versus the society image side of it. That I think it can be combative if people address that more. And it's hard too, because it's, you know, maybe that takes time or energy or something like that. Yeah. But I mean,
well, that's where PMTA comes into play. They're really good advocates for, you know, everything you just said, putting all the positive spin on everything, helping the trucking companies with legislation and with regulations and everything that goes on with that. I'm on the board, the Lancaster chapter board for PMTA, and, you know, we have a golf outing every year. We have a scholarship fund. We're having a family picnic in July at Hershey Park. There'll probably be upwards of 1,000 people there just for our event.
Yep.
And, you know, when you go to that event, that's what you see families, you see, you know, all these people involved in the trucking industry, and it's all the positive things. So we need to be able to get all that positive out into the world and show people that, yeah, we work hard, but then we do enjoy life and we do have these kind of fun events and we're just regular people like everybody else.
Oh, totally. And speaking of PMTA, so I'm from Oregon and came from, you know, the West Coast before moving out here, and I was involved with the Oregon Trucking Association. And any of these associations, you know, the other focus, legislators and state capitals, and talking in the ear of people that are actually making these laws, or that you actually need to convince to the realities of what this law will do or won't do, and trying to convince these people. It's quite amazing how involved, or how organizations like PMTA can speak in the ear of people on the state capitol and be able to, you know, change regulation to something that we want, where, you know, owner operator or trucker driving down the road, they might voice that, or, you know, what's their opportunity is to be able to write a letter to Congress or whatever, who knows where that goes. But I mean, I agree. Like, that's why organizations like PMTA is so important.
It's impressive. It's huge. And a lot of the things with legislation, the people that are bringing these laws to the table, they haven't seen the other side of what it's going to do.
Yeah.
Or like the latest is the CARB legislation that's going through. You know, if you don't hear the other side of it, you know, no one wants dirty water. Everyone wants clean air.
Right.
The whole nine yards. But look at, if you look at the trucking industry from the late 70s, early 80s to now, I think the statistic is it takes like 18 trucks from today to equal one truck emissions from 30 years ago.
Yep.
You know, so look at how far we've come in such a in relatively short amount of time, still march forward for the future, but to some of the, let's have some incremental change.
Correct.
You know, we can't keep doubling down every few years on the emissions issues.
Yeah, because I mean, it's literally, I think what, so Pennsylvania adopted CARB, which is California Air Rules Regulations. And of course, California has some crazy deadlines that they're trying. I think, 2036, they want all new heavy-duty vehicles to be electric or zero emission or something like that. And that's literally like 13 years.
Yeah.
Infrastructure needs to be put in place. The vehicles themselves need to be proven for, you know, short, regional, and then long haul. Like the reality of that transition is ridiculous. So PA is trying to potentially, well, at least the PMTA, can we please get off of the CARB standards and, you know, focus on what Pennsylvanians want, not just what California is stressing. And really, a lot of this, too, is just regulations in general. Carriers and then suppliers have to change and adapt to different regulation changes, hours of service changes. I think your dad mentioned in an article a while back, but he's like, there hasn't been hours of service changes for 65 years from like the 40s to the 2000. And then there's been like 10 different times they've changed the regulations. And I mean, now you got the ELD, and then there was 2020 had some more changes to it, little tweaks to it, but still. I'm curious, how does your company adapt to regulatory changes like this and, you know, even suppliers?
That's where PMTA comes in. Mm-hmm. We lean very heavily on them for staying up to date on all the regulatory changes, making sure we're current. The other thing with some of the regulatory changes, you have to keep your customers current on that as well.
Yeah.
Like with the ELD, when they switched to ELDs a few years back, you know, some of our loads were being tendered 24 hours in advance.
Right.
So we would get a load on, we would get a load tendered on Monday. It would load Tuesday, deliver Wednesday. And with that kind of cycle, you don't have a lot of planning. So we got with some of our customers and said, hey, you know, this is coming down the line. We really need to schedule out further. And they were able to change some of their load tendering so we would get them get more notice before the load would come, because they didn't want any disruptions in what they were doing.
Right.
With the supply chain issues we've had over the past few years, I think I'm hoping some of the regulators have seen some of that and maybe take a step back and say, okay, having a one-size-fits-all approach for these regulations, maybe we have to look at something differently.
Right.
If you look at the ELD exemptions versus it's all, the exemptions is almost larger than the rule.
Yeah.
You know, totally. So it's kind of it's a little difficult. You know, if you're hauling cattle, well, you can't just stop and take a 10-hour break. You know, if you have to keep moving, or you have to get them to water or something, you know.
Right.
And then the trucking industry itself is so diverse. You know, the things that move on, I mean, everything moves on a truck. And when I say everything, I mean everything. You see truckloads of bees, truckloads of live fish, you know, like there's all this wild stuff out there, and just to throw a standard regulation on everything just doesn't cut it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest one to explain in this is the speed limiter rule that they're thinking about tossing out there. For industry, it's very simple. Oh, let's just say, I don't know, 68 miles per hour is the limit we're going to set. I drove through Wyoming, and it's wide open roads, and the speed limit's like 80. Why have it be 65 there where, sure, 65 in maybe New York or something like that, that's pretty fast. Like, each state should have some flexibility, or each type of road should have some flexibility, or something, which then the technology has to have some flexibility to it, too. So it, just even with that example, it just seems, if they get ahead of themselves, then it's just, it ends up hurting more, I think, than helping. And we've seen that in the facts. ELD came out saying, well, I know they touted like saving 26 lives a year, which it's still important that they're saving lives. But honestly, crashes were up. Fatalities were up since then. And then a lot of these hours of service changes have been coming after that, trying to give a little bit more flexibility back. Okay, we went a little harsh. Okay, let's try to fix it now. And who knows what's going to happen with that down the road. But yeah, it's all interesting. And so I'm curious, you know, you, Jack Trucks, your dad, been involved with PMTA for a long time. What were some of the wins that you've seen PMTA do with some of the, say, maybe state regulations? I don't know if you have any examples.
There's been a few over the past few years. Some of the, like, this sounds like a small, there's some small wins in here, but the amount of effort it took to get some of these through, like the weight class sticker. Mm-hmm. You used to have a weight class sticker. If you didn't have a weight class sticker, there was some huge fine. Yep. Well, PMTA got that weight class sticker removed.
Yep. Off the truck.
You used to have your truck inspected every 6 months. Mm-hmm. PMTA got that changed. Just recently, they got the carb pushed out to 2027.
Yes.
From 2024. They also got the bridge tolling.
Right.
Pushed out. They got with Senator Langerholt. There's a few other ones. I know he was the main sponsor of that bill. Without PMTA, especially bridge tolling, without someone pushing back, I mean, we would have bridge tolls on 83 and every other bridge in every other city across the state. That's something, you know, Pennsylvania already has one of the highest fuel taxes in the nation. And then if we don't have anybody to keep an eye on what's happening in Harrisburg and saying, hey, well, this isn't good for the industry, this isn't good for the people of Pennsylvania, we would be in some trouble.
I'm curious, since you mentioned fuel taxes, one of the things, you know, at least for the everyday driver, you know, electric vehicles are coming a lot quicker than maybe people were expecting even a decade ago, which when it comes to electric vehicles, then they're not going to the gas pump and getting fuel taxes, which the state takes a piece of to help roads be fixed, updated, modernized, whatever. So the revenue loss with EVs and other more fuel efficient vehicles on the roads, there's been discussions, vehicle mileage tax versus just a fuel tax at gas stations and things like that. I'm curious, eventually something will eventually need to change. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that. So vehicle mileage tax, they might have like a telematic device in everyday vehicles so they can measure the miles you're driving versus just at the gas pump.
From a trucking company's perspective, it seems relatively simple to change the amount of fuel tax because you're already tracking all your miles for IFTA instead of trying to overhaul an entire system.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where that goes moving forward for sure. And it is. It does seem like a lot of the states are just picking on, the big trucks are easier to tax. They're not going to complain, or we can get away with it. It's crazy. But I'm curious. So back to drivers. I know one of the reasons why I especially wanted to invite you onto the podcast. We have a trucking job board at our CDL school, cnstrains.com, and we offer the jobs for the CDL jobs that are coming up for Jag Trucks and others. I'm curious, why should a driver work for Jag Trucks?
I feel we're a good spot for, if, like we were talking earlier about owner operators, if you have any inkling of wanting to own your own truck someday, we put you in a company truck. You know the program, you know the system. The thing that with Jag Trucks that's different than a lot of other carriers is we pay percentage. So you get a direct percentage of what that truck is generating. You're almost like a partner, you know? So you get a settlement sheet every week, says these are loads you hold, this is what they paid, here's your percentage, and then there's your check at the end of the week.
Nice.
So with that being said, we pay our company driver's percentage, we pay our owner-operator's percentage. Owner-operator gets a higher percentage, obviously, because they have a lot more expense.
Right.
But it's very simple to look at your pay stub and say, well, if I own my own truck, here's my percentage. This is would be my pay at the end of the week. These are my approximate costs.
Yep.
It's very simple for someone that wants to go from a company driver to an owner-operator to see where they would be without just kind of jumping in the deep end.
Right.
Some of the other things we have for company drivers, we have a very robust health insurance package. We pay 100% of your dental vision. We have a life insurance policy. I think it's $50,000 we pay for a life insurance policy for all of our employees.
Right, nice.
We also cover 75% of your healthcare cost for you and your family. So
that's
you
awesome.
Have 15 kids and
yeah.
We would cover whatever the 75% not only for you but them as well. I know some companies you go in, they'll cover the employee and that's it. So we think it's very important to have good benefits to attract good people. We have vacation, paid holidays. We have lunch in the office a lot.
Well, I think I was reading, maybe your dad was mentioning this before too, but like great heating and AC, refrigerator in the truck, or other little amenities.
Our drivers, we have local, like our local trucks would be anywhere you could be out and back in a day.
Right.
So basically a 200-mile radius of Marietta, Pennsylvania, yep. is what you'd operate for a local driver. Then our regional guys would be out about a week at a time. The most they would be out is leave Sunday, get home Friday or Saturday.
Right.
We have nice amenities in the truck, but you don't need to carry everything in the kitchen sink because you're not going to be gone for a month at a time.
Exactly. Well, with that, thank you so much for joining me, Zach. I know that we covered a whole lot of information on this. If anybody watching wants a comment, have any questions, if you're looking to get a job, getting in the industry, and want to reach out to Zach, leave a comment down in the down below, and we'll let him know. And of course, we've got links to other information to the trucking job board, where you can see what jobs are open. And I'm sure their website, you can go to there and check more information out as well. Like us, subscribe, go follow Jag Trucks as well on social media. And again, thanks for joining us. And as always, stay safe out there.